So before we actually begin, let's take a moment and reflect on our motivation and let our heart and mind open to include all living beings in our field of compassion, and to know that by improving the state of our own mind, by generating our own good qualities, we'll be able to be of greater benefit to other living beings. Then let's have that aspiration to do just that with a motivation of compassion, so that through sharing Buddha's teachings together today, we can make a positive contribution to the lives of those around us, to society, and ultimately to all living beings. Let's have that as our motivation today. Okay, so we've been going through this book, Don't Believe Everything You Think, for the last, I don't know how many, Sundays, once a month, and, explaining one verse each Sunday. So this time we are on verse number 26, which is about ethical conduct. And ethical conduct basically means stopping harming others and ourselves. Yeah? So not harming ourselves, not harming others. So the book is based on a poem. It was verse 26 of this poem, written in Tibet several centuries ago, but the contents of the poem really apply to our own lives in 21st century Western society as well. So I'll read you the verse and then talk about it a little bit. So the verse says, without ethics, you can't accomplish your own well-being. So wanting to accomplish others is laughable. He tells it straight. Therefore, without worldly aspirations, safeguard your ethical conduct. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So bodhisattvas are beings who cultivate very deep compassion for all other living beings equally, so much so that whenever they see any living being, their spontaneous reaction is, I want to attain the ultimate perfection of my own mind, supreme awakening, for the benefit of that being. Yeah. So they're quite a bit different than us, you know. We see some living being and say, why do they wear their hair like that? Why do they walk like that? You know? What political party are they anyway? Yeah? So we greet people and, you know, already the mind is discriminating and judging and so on. So bodhisattvas greet people very different state of mind. It's that being is exactly like me, wanting happiness, not wanting suffering. Yeah? Happiness is something good, no matter whose it is. Suffering is something to get rid of, no matter whose it is. So let's get to work, you know, and bring about happiness and pacify misery. Yeah, so we're aspiring bodhisattvas, you can say. Yeah. So that's why we study these practices of the bodhisattvas, so that we can train our minds to approach life like they do. Okay? So So let's look at the verse more carefully. Without ethics, you cannot accomplish your own well-being. So here, by ethics, sometimes the term is translated as morality, but I don't like the connotations of the English word morality very much. Yeah, because it often sounds to me like morality is something that someone outside invented and is imposing on us. And that's not the way Buddhists approach ethical conduct. Yeah, it's not a system created by Buddha or anybody else that is dictated to us. But rather, when you look, when beings have happiness, you know, what are the causes of that? We call that good ethical conduct. When they have suffering, what are the causes of that? Yeah, imperfect ethical conduct. So it's more on an experiential level, okay? And here we're not talking about having happiness like the very next moment after you do something, but, you know, the long-term happiness. So, basically, you know, the bottom line it comes down to, when we harm other living beings intentionally, you know, with a mind that is angry or vengeful or, you know, some kind of negative, jealous, some kind of negative motivation, and then we harm others, then we not only, you know, impact the lives of others, but we impact our own mental state. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, we're the only ones who really live with ourselves. Yeah. And when we go to bed at night, it doesn't matter how many people praise us and how many people blame us, because we're the only ones who know our real motivation and our real actions. Yeah? So if we harm others with a really, you know, we want to inflict harm, you know, let's give them a taste of their own medicine. We may be successful, but then when we're alone, do we feel good about ourselves? Yeah? Do we feel good about ourselves? When we're on our deathbed and we look back at our life, do we feel good about those kinds of actions? Okay, so I don't know about you, but when my mind gets overrun by anger and resentment and revenge and so on, I may do all sorts of things and initially say, good, I got even. But then inside I feel like, boy, what kind of person am I that I rejoice at harming somebody else? Yeah, so it doesn't contribute to self-respect, yeah, and harms the other person, harms us. In Buddhist terms, because we believe in karma, that what we do creates the causes for our experience, when we do harmful actions, we're actually creating the cause sometime in the future to experience harm ourselves. So, you know, so when he said, without ethics you can't accomplish your own well-being, if we really look at our own experience, that's true. Yeah, that's true. We don't feel good about ourselves. Yeah, and we have lots of regrets. And then we start stockpiling inside of ourselves all the things that we hope nobody else in the world ever knows about us. Do you have a backpack full of those things? You know, things I did and said that I'm sure glad these people don't have clairvoyant powers, because I don't want anybody to know I did this. Yeah. So we stack these things up, you know, we put them in a psychological backpack, yeah, and carry them around with us all the time. And so no wonder, you know, psychologically, it affects us. We don't feel well. Now we're carrying around all this remorse and guilt, you know, which don't serve us, don't make us happy. So ethical conduct is learning to restrain from doing that. Yeah, it's learning to observe the mind, to see what our motivations are. And when our motivations are rotten, to like pause and don't carry out the action, you know, under the influence of a rotten motivation, but transform our motivation, make it into a good motivation, yeah, one that wants to benefit ourselves and others, then look at the situation again and see what is the best course of action. Okay? So in that way, we actually prevent a lot of pain for ourselves and others. If we blow it, which many times we do, because we aren't very aware, and, you know, the negative emotion, the anger comes up, and it's out of our mouth before we can, you know, blink an eye, and then, you know, we dump some anger on somebody else, or we do something really nasty towards somebody else. So that happens sometimes. So then we need to purify it, yeah, to have regret, to make a determination not to do it again, to learn the antidotes to anger and revenge and resentment and jealousy, so that if those mental states come up in us in the future, yeah, instead of letting them control our mind, we can apply the antidotes and learn to think in a different way, how to look at the situation in a different way. So it's not a thing of suppressing the bad emotion. It's a thing of looking at the situation in a different way so that our rotten motivation just automatically evaporates by itself. There's nothing to suppress. Okay? So, but when we don't do that, then we can't accomplish our own well-being. We make a lot of enemies. Wouldn't you agree? Yeah? When we have rotten, you know, bad, well, put it this way, what we really want in our hearts is to have good relationships with other people. Isn't it? Wouldn't you say that? But that's what we all want. So when we don't have good relationships with them, why is it? Yeah. Well, they may have some responsibility. We may have some responsibility. So we have to look at our responsibility, because that's the only part of it we can do something about. And then we look and we say, oh, you know, maybe I had a rather self-centered motivation. Yeah, maybe I wasn't aware of how the situation looked to them, or I wasn't aware of how they tend to misinterpret different things. Yeah, or I wasn't aware of what their buttons are. And so, or I had a, you know, so that's ignorance, a motivation of ignorance. Or maybe I was just being quite self-centered and wanting my own way. Or maybe I was dumping my anger on them, or getting even, or giving them a taste of their own medicine for their own good. Right? Yeah. We're doing it for their own good. Right. yeah? So, you know, seeing that, then okay, have some regret. Make a determination not to do it again. Yeah? Approach the other person, and if we need to apologize, apologize. Yeah? If we can't apologize, leave that, but change our own minds, so that we have a different attitude towards them, so that we're not carrying around that heaviness of the bad emotion. Okay? So we do some purification, then we can reestablish our own well-being. The second line he says, so wanting to accomplish others is laughable. So if we can't, you know, establish our own well-being because we have lousy ethical conduct, then how in the world are we going to help anybody else? Yeah? Because how can we help others if we can't stop harming them? Yeah? It's difficult, isn't it? Yeah? And I think really in our hearts, all of us, that's what we want. We want our lives to be meaningful. We want to be able to help others. We want to solve more problems, you know, on this planet than we create. Yeah? I don't think anybody really wants to create more problems. We already have so many. You know, who needs more? But because these afflicted mental states take over, then we wind up not being able to accomplish our own well-being, let alone others' well-being. Yeah. So we have to begin, you know, by having good ethical conduct. The way I put that in modern language is good ethical conduct means stop being a jerk. Yeah? That's basically what it means, is stop being a jerk. Because when we harm others physically, that's kind of a jerk-like action, isn't it? I mean, what do we expect? You go slug somebody, you expect them to say, oh, you're wonderful? Yeah? Do you expect the police to come and say, oh, no problem, you knocked that guy out cold on the sidewalk. Good going. You know, it's like, yeah? So we're just creating problems for ourselves, so let's stop being a jerk and not harm others physically. Same with taking things that don't belong to us. Yeah? If we take people's stuff and don't return it, yeah? Even if we cook the books so nobody knows it, you know, then still, you know, what are we doing? We're creating a whole bunch of problems for other people and ourselves. So that's jerkish. Yeah. Is that a good adjective for being a jerk?
Or jerky.
Jerky? Is it jerky or jerkable or jerkish? Okay, it's being a jerk. Yeah. Similarly, you know, having unkind or unwise sexual relationships with people, you know, not using preventative measures if you don't want pregnancy or to stop STDs, that's kind of a foolish thing to do. You know, using somebody for your own pleasure without caring for them, that's kind of foolish. Yeah? Same with lying. You know? Lying is a really jerky.
Jerk-like.
It's a really jerk-like action. You know, just ask Bill Clinton. Ask any politician if lying pays off. Yeah, when early in their career, they'll tell you yes. Later in their career, they will tell you no. Okay. That lying just makes a mess. Mm-hmm. So all these kinds of things, you know, telling other people off, criticizing them up, down, talking behind their back, all this kind of stuff is, you know, it makes a mess in our present life. And, you know, it's jerk-like, so it's, you know, unethical conduct. And it puts the seeds in our mind so that we will experience problems in the future. You know, later this life, or as Buddhists we say also in future lives. So we already have enough problems, why create more? And the world has enough problems, why create more? Hmm? So we need to really guard our mind to do that because, you know, the actions we do are done physically and verbally, but without the mind having the motivation, the body and the mouth don't move. Yeah? So to have really good ethical conduct, we have to really guard our mind. You know? And see, what am I thinking? Yeah? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? And to notice that when you have different emotions, especially the negative ones, or the disturbing ones, there's always a story behind it. Yeah, I'm mad because they did da 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 da. Yeah. Have you noticed it's never I'm mad because I have the seed of anger in myself. It's never that, is it? It's I'm mad because it's somebody else's fault. Yeah? And then we go around blaming other people. And what good does that do? Yeah, that doesn't do much good. We can blame people all they want. They often don't accept it. And instead they point the finger back at us and say, it's your fault. And we go, me? Didn't do anything. Yeah, we play real innocent and sweet. Okay? So, without ethics, you can't accomplish your own well-being. So wanting to accomplish others is laughable. So the remedy for the situation. Therefore, without worldly aspiration, safeguard your ethical conduct. Now, what does it mean, without worldly aspiration? It means without getting conceited, thinking that we are keeping the best ethical conduct of anybody. You know, I am so pure, I don't harm anybody, I am, you know, Miss Goody Two-Shoes incarnate, yeah, combined with Pollyanna and, you know, whatever else. Yeah, and so getting very arrogant over our good ethical conduct, yeah? So replacing anger and the wish to harm with arrogance and the wish to dominate isn't a spectacular achievement. Okay? So what we want to do is, you know, when we keep ethical conduct, when we guard our mind and look at what we're thinking and feeling, when we refrain from doing negative actions and speaking in a disturbing way to others, yeah, to do that as simply with the motivation, wanting ourselves to be happy and wanting the other person to be happy. It's not done with the motivation that then I'm going to be some holy, fantastic person who can hold my nose in the air because, you know, I keep my precepts and such good ethical conduct. Yeah. And therefore people will admire me, you know. They'll think I'm the next Dalai Lama or the next Mother Teresa because I can, you know, snow them with all my fantastic, you know, compassionate qualities that are all motivated by egoism. So we don't need that, thank you very much. Okay, so that's what he's saying, you know. Without worldly aspirations, safeguard your ethical conduct. Okay, so when I did this book was a lot of fun to do. I wanted to put in stories that were from real life people, you know, who faced a life situation that was related to the different verses in the text. And so by sitting around at the kitchen table, you know, I listened to a lot of stories, and then people started sending in stories. So all the stories are true. Yeah, they're really good ones. So I thought I'd put them in the book. So I thought I'd read you a little bit. One of the stories is very long, so I won't. This story's really long. So I'll read another one first, and then I'll come back to the one that's long and abbreviate for you. Okay, so this one, the title of the story is Practicing What I Preach. I've always thought that I knew what was best for others. Does that sound like you? Do you know what's best for other people? What they should do, what they should not do? Yes. Yeah, and the problem is they don't follow our advice. So I always thought that I knew what was best for others. I love to give advice. But practicing what I preach is not so easy. It's as if giving advice to others prevented me from looking at how I was living my own life. I see it. Being a hypocrite is a form of laziness, since I want the whole world to change while I do nothing to cultivate my own integrity. I would be outraged by CEOs cheating their companies and clients out of billions of dollars and not getting punished, while I worked for people and got paid under the table. I would complain and whine about others' faults, not realizing that I was looking into a mirror and seeing myself. Since I met the Dharma, and in particular since I became ordained, I have become very aware that I find fault in others and that those faults exist in me too. While my self-centered attitude finds it tempting to clean up my behavior just to look good so that others will like me, it's a worldly motivation, isn't it? I now focus on correcting my behavior of body, speech, and mind for my own peace of mind and in order to be more kind and open-hearted with others. Okay, now the long one. Let's just read a little bit and come back to it. So, recently during a Dharma discussion with friends, I had a big aha moment. Sharing this experience might prevent new Dharma students from experiencing the suffering arising from my own mistaken steps along the path. We often associate Dharma practice with sitting on the cushion more than with our day-to-day activities in between sitting sessions. Okay. For many years, I was absolutely convinced that if I just steadfastly applied myself to daily meditation and supplemented that practice with Dharma study, eventually my concentration would improve to the point of attaining some significant realizations. It made sense, really, practice, 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 and in time I would become a great meditator and that would make my life meaningful. I would become a great meditator. In fact, the better I became at meditating, the more certain I was that my life would become more peaceful and balanced as well. Only now, years later, do I see the folly of that concept of Dharma practice. Okay. So he said, while of course over time my meditative concentration did improve, it did so only to up to a certain point. Then I experienced a growing sense of being stuck. It didn't seem like I was progressing, and at times it felt like I was even backsliding. At the same time, I became very adept at making excuses for lapses in ethical behavior, often under the guise of having compassion for myself. In my mind, I operated under the implicit assumption that when my meditative stability improved and when realizations flowed from that, then I would worry about attending to my ethical conduct. So first I'm going to become this great practitioner with single-pointed concentration that everybody goes, wow, look at him. And then I'll worry about my ethical conduct. Okay. And then with the excuses he was saying to himself, he said, I said, my ethical conduct is a lot better than it was 10 years ago or even 3 years ago, and it is probably not fair to expect more of me as a lay practitioner, surrounded by all the temptations, distractions, and comforts of the modern world. Why should I expect myself to have good ethical content? Yeah? Okay. So, he said, thanks to the confluence of hearing a lucid commentary on the stages of the path, and the steady hand of my spiritual mentor guiding me along the path, it finally dawned on me that the reason I was stuck was because I was placing too much emphasis on meditation and not nearly enough on the practice of ethical conduct. So now I fully appreciate why the three higher trainings are in the order of ethical conduct, then concentration, finally wisdom. Yeah, because ethical conduct is actually the easy one. Concentration is harder, wisdom is even harder. And the thing is, when we cultivate ethical conduct, we improve, we strengthen two mental factors. One is called mindfulness, the other is called introspective awareness. So mindfulness remembers our values, it remembers our precepts. It remembers, you know, what a good ethical life is. And then introspective awareness checks up and sees, am I living according to my precepts and my values? Yeah. Or am I, you know, off in the land of afflictions, prancing around with, you know, with my disturbing mental states? Okay? So if we develop mindfulness and introspective awareness with respect to our daily life actions, you know, so ethical conduct, then by strengthening those in that situation, when we sit down to meditate and we're working really just with our mind, then it's much easier to concentrate because our mindfulness and introspective awareness are already stronger. They've been strengthened. Also, it's easier to concentrate because we aren't filled with so much remorse. Because when we don't keep in good ethical conduct, we sit down to meditate, and what's going through our mind? Yeah. Why did I say that to that person? It was such a stupid thing to say. And then, of course, we make up excuses. Well, I said that because they did this, 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 this. So it was really actually for their own good that I said it. But then, still inside of ourselves when we're meditating, I hope nobody finds out that I did that. <You know? laughs> So we know that we don't really feel very good about it. Yeah. So, you know, that kind of regret and remorse becomes a big distraction in our meditation. Yeah. Whereas if we are able to restrain ourselves to start with, we prevent that problem. And even, like I said, when we do make mistakes, we do purification, and then that kind of cuts it. Okay. So, let's see. So now he says, I meditate in the morning and evening, but it seems the real purpose of my meditation practice is to keep me conscientious and mindful during the intervening hours. So his mind has changed. Yeah. Of course, all it takes is losing mindfulness for a brief moment to suffer an ethical downfall in the form of acting on a disturbing emotion, lashing out in anger at somebody, talking behind somebody's back, adjusting the truth, i.e. lying. We inhabit such a treacherous landscape in our mind. This person, by the way, was a lawyer. So you can see, and he's very good at making arguments, so he was very good at making arguments in his mind to validate some of his, you know, dicey behavior. So it was interesting that he kind of woke up about it. So he said, so the good news is I am beginning to gain mastery over my afflictions, and I'm beginning to practice ethical conduct with more interest and vigor. Now that I am emphasizing this aspect of my Dharma practice, I am definitely noticing that my concentration is improving. I can't say I've had any special realizations at this point, except for maybe a deeper understanding of renunciation, which fortifies my determination to live ethically. And then he talks about, he talks a bit about renunciation, and he says, after almost 11 years now of dedicated practice, that is where I am, trying to cultivate true renunciation. Renunciation means giving up our afflictions and our suffering, you know, and trying to create the causes for happiness instead. Of course, I am also happier than I ever thought possible. The happiness I now have is more stable and not as subject to the whims of circumstance, and my life has meaning. At the beginning, I never would have associated renunciation with happiness, but now I see that the more I apply antidotes to my attachment and my obsession with the happiness of only this life, the better my ethical conduct becomes. Good ethical conduct, in turn, means less guilt, fewer regrets, yeah, fewer enemies, fewer complaints, and thus makes concentration and meditation easier. Good ethical conduct also makes me more honest with myself and others, so that less time is spent in rationalization, justification, and denial. So ethical conduct is psychologically healthy. Okay. Now I have more ability to feel genuine compassion for myself and others. So that his last paragraph says, my conclusion is to avoid placing the cart before the horse on the path to enlightenment. Embrace ethical conduct. It is the quickest accelerant along the path. Many of us start out thinking that the hardest thing is wrapping our mind around the idea of the nature of reality. However, a true renunciation of afflicted states of mind is the hardest thing for modern lay practitioners. And this is not possible without ethical conduct. Until we get that, we are just pretending to practice the Dharma. One of my teachers said it best, following desire is not practicing the Dharma. Not following desire is practicing the Dharma. Okay? So he learned from his experience. Okay, so we have some time for questions and answers and comments. I'd like to open it up to you to... Yes?
Well, I was just thinking about the non-virtue of harmful speech. For me, that could include emails and texts. Because, like, I noticed in the past, well, even sometimes now, if I'm not careful about the state of my mind, if it's agitated or irritated or even a rotten motivation, and I hit that send button, I almost always regret it. It's very joke-like. So not good. So I've kind of like tried to be more mindful of if my mind is agitated to just take a step back, maybe go on the balcony, have a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, maybe, or just even wait overnight if I have to, if it's that agitated, and not be so impulsive about trying to create more harm.
Does anybody else besides Dan and me have that problem? Oh, I know so well what you're talking about. Yeah? You're agitated. The person's not there, so you don't need to really face them. You can just sit and, you know, And then they read it, and we don't have to see what their face looks like after we've said something that may be insulting or, you know, painful to them. But then, like you say, you know, I mean, I've had that experience, like I press send and then I go, oh God, what did I do? And so I've taken with those kinds of things, like I put it in my draft box. Yeah. So, you know, you have a good idea, go out and have a cup of tea, calm yourself down, then see if that's what I really want to do. So, you know, I kind of put it in the draft box and then do the same thing and then usually come back and delete it after that, yeah. But to give ourselves some space to really think, is that really what I want to communicate to the other person? Yeah.
A number of years ago, you spoke at the Heart Sutra Relic Tour, I believe it was called. Mm-hmm. I asked you a question at that time about anger, especially as a parent. I was struggling with sort of explosive anger at the moment. And you said, have you ever noticed how there's that instant before? And you spoke to that, and I remember going home thinking, I don't think there's any instant before. With that awareness, I started to find that instant. But I still struggle with much less explosive anger, but unconsciousness in how the harshness of my words affects my child. I just have a real skill at expressing my emotions, even my negative ones, mm-hmm. way too readily. So I wondered, you know, that the awareness of finding the instant before anger was very useful for me. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could speak more to that point of developing skills that create that space and... So not even just anger, but the harshness of my words, my tone, my lack of awareness.
Mm. Okay. Well, the thing is, when you find, like, the moment before the anger is big, when the anger is small, then press the pause button at that point and say, Mommy needs a timeout. Yeah? And then go calm yourself down. Yeah, think of exactly, you know, what is it that is troubling? What is it that you really need to communicate? And then when you're calmer, go back and communicate that. Yeah, because often, first of all, do you find yourself saying things that your parents said to you that you vowed you'd never say to your child? Yeah? Other parents in the room, is that true for you too? Things you said, when I have a kid, I will never say to my kid. And there it is, coming right out of your mouth. Yeah? So, you know, to become aware of that and really think, wow, you know, when this was said to me, this is how I felt, and I don't want to do that to my child. So I really need to slow down here. Yeah, and because a lot of times when you're angry at a child, what comes out of our mouth is not necessarily useful information for the child. It's usually insults. You're such a horrible child, I trusted you and you did this, and then, you know, and then how am I ever going to trust you again, and you're such a creep, and you're, you know, you're not like Jimmy and Joni across the street, and how come you aren't like them? Of course, we always say, you aren't like Mrs. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so across the street who let them have their good, you know, things that you don't let us have, that, but that doesn't count. you know, so we, you know, we don't necessarily give the child any useful information, except they know that we're mad. That's the one thing, because the tone of our voice, our language, the word, you know, you're a creep, you're an insane, why did I ever have you, you know, I could murder you.
I find I don't say things, but that's what they hear anyway. things.
Yeah.
I'm not saying those things, but the harshness of the attitude and the words.
Yeah. Now, my mother used to say, I could kill you. I didn't believe her, but, you know, which was good. But she would say that, you know. I'm so mad at you, I could kill you. yeah, so kids, you know, whether you say it or not, you know, it's there. So, what you want to do if a child misbehaves is give them useful feedback. Yeah. When I try and walk in your room and there's stuff all over and your toys are all over the floor, so I could very easily trip and fall on the things, and you know, that worries me that I'll trip and fall, or you or somebody else will trip and fall over the things on the floor. So, you know, to protect other people, could you keep your room clean? Yeah. So you have to explain the reason why, like how that behavior is adversely affecting somebody else. And then the child is more likely to get, oh, that's why they're unhappy, because this behavior is leading to that kind of result. Otherwise, you know, all the kid knows is, you know, mom's or dad's flying off the handle. I don't really understand what I did wrong. Maybe I said such and such, but what's wrong with saying such and such? Yeah, I hear mom and dad say such and such all the time. I just said it too. Why are they yelling at me? Yeah. So, you know, to really see what is the specific incident and give them feedback about that, and not tie the behavior to you're a good person or you're a bad person. Yeah, so you're commenting on the behavior, you're not commenting on the qualities of the person. And that's much more useful for a child. It's much more useful for adults, too. You know, when somebody communicates to us the specific thing, you know, and why that is disturbing to them.
I find that a negative habit of mind that I get into, where I'm oftentimes, say in work, I paint a picture in my mind of this person and the foolish things they're doing, are based on my insecurity or my fear. And it's hard to catch that. And I, you know, and maybe that comment of that moment before, but I'm aware of it oftentimes later, that, oh, that was from fear, that was from your own insecurity, that you started painting this horrible picture about their intentions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's 2020 hindsight.
Yes. Yes. And that's the whole thing about, you know, just, you know, sometimes I say to myself, children, you can talk later. Because it's like the words are like, I've got to say them right now, otherwise the world's going to fall apart. Yeah. To say to myself, no, you can, you know, you can say that later. First calm your mind down and see what's going on. But it's true, we very often say things out of our own insecurity, our own fear. Very often, isn't it? And it's very common that, you know, when we see faults in another person, why are we able to identify that fault so well? Because we know it very well, because we have it. Yeah? And so it can sometimes be quite useful for us, like, okay, why am I noticing that particular fault in that person? Well, I have it too. Yeah. I'm not saying we all have it to the same amounts or degrees, but I find it very useful when somebody is doing something that I don't like to reflect on the times when I've done that same behavior. And then it becomes like, okay, this is why when I acted like this that I got the response I did, and I need to change in the future and so in those kind of situations.
Mm-hmm. The next stage on that is developing empathy for the person. I've experienced what you experience. I know what it's like. And just send them up.
Yeah.
It just calms everything.
Yeah. So when you're in a dispute situation, you know, to be able to, when you find that affliction in yourself, then to be able to empathize with the person who has it at that particular moment, you know, and say, I know what that feels like. I've been like, I've been like that. I've been there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was born into a family of several children, and a lot of times you talk about kids fight when they're little kids.
Kids what?
Kids fight with each other. They say a lot of harmful things when they're little kids. Mm-hmm. What happens several decades later when all these things still go on and you're, excuse me for saying this, but you're stuck being related to somebody and it's, you can't walk away from it. So, and you feel like you've tried everything. Maybe you haven't, because there's always something, but you feel like you're surrounded by several toxic relationships. Mm-hmm. And it's you're still related. So mm-hmm. because of the bonds of life, you keep coming into contact with these things, these relationships that you really maybe would have walked away from, mm-hmm. but you're related.
Yeah.
I don't even know if there's an answer to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know very well what you're talking about. I think probably most people know. Yeah. So one thing I do is I realize that I do have control over how often I see somebody. So I regulate that, you know, and I don't see the person too often. Yeah. Second thing I do is I look at what are the roles that we play, you know, because in family things we tend to have a specific role and then we just replay the role in different situations. Yeah, so-and-so's the bossy one, so-and-so's the one who just stomps out, so-and-so's, yeah, the one who cries, and we just replay it in different situations. So I look and I get in my mind a good idea of the dynamics and especially how I have put myself into a role. Now I could say they've put me into that role. And maybe they have, but the thing is, I bit the hook. So I can't really say they put me in that role. They may have conditioned things, but I said, oh yes, that's who I am. And so that's my role. I'm always the one who does, but da-da-da-da-da-da. You know? So it becomes like push button. They say this, I say this. And then the whole scene starts again. And that's what we call a toxic relationship. Okay? So I look at like, what it is that I'm doing, my role, and then ask myself, how else could I act instead of playing that role? You know? Instead of seeing myself as the person who's always getting blamed, what about if I saw myself as the person who has the opportunity to look at somebody else with compassion? Yeah? What about if I saw myself as the person who could crack jokes? You know, so you adopt a different identity, and if we stop acting in the same way, the other people can't act in that way. You know? Because it takes, what is it, takes two to tango? You know? So if, like, I stop doing the dance, the other person can't continue. One thing I find helpful for myself, you know, after I've really seen my role in conventional worldly terms, is to think, now what would happen if the Buddha were in that situation? Yeah, they're the people I'm related to, my family. what would happen if the Buddha were one of them, you know, in my shoes? And how would the Buddha look at this situation? Yeah? And then I see, wow, a whole spectrum of other ways to feel and other ways to act open up. Yeah? Because a Buddha in the situation is not going to get defensive, is not going to get angry, is not going to have to set the boundary, is not going to have to run out of the room because they can't take it, is not going to fold into tears. A Buddha's going to sit there and, you know, think, here's a suffering sentient being. Yeah? And sit there and think, these words are simply sounds. They're simply sounds. I have a choice of how to interpret them. They don't have any meaning inside of them, and they don't have to generate certain emotions inside of me. Yeah? And, you know, and then if you think, okay, if the Buddha were here, what would the Buddha do? Yeah? Maybe everybody's making fun of you, you know? Maybe the Buddha then joins in. Yeah? Yeah. I was reading the new Karmapa. He's about 30 years old or something. No, younger than that. Anyway, he was saying that one of his tutors would often scold him, you know? And, oh, what a lazy kid you are, and, you know, you're supposed to be studying, and you're supposed to be something. And he said he really didn't like being scolded. But sometimes, you know, it was like, there might be a little bit truth. So he joined in with this teacher. Said, yeah, you know, this student really is awfully lazy and doesn't pay good attention. You know? And he just joined in with it. And you join in, and then, yeah, where's it going to go? Yeah? Yeah. I mean, sometimes I would just say to my mom, you know, it's really too bad, Mom, you have such a dingbat daughter. Dad, what's she going to say? You know? Yeah? Yeah?
When you talk about mirroring, people mirroring behavior to you, and I think about that a lot, and the only way I've learned to identify what my part is by however strong my obsession is with their bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, it's really hard for me to identify in the moment, even after it, because I'm so much in denial that that behavior belongs to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes it's that behavior belongs to me. Sometimes I'm doing another behavior that's triggering that in the other person. So we have to see, when does it belong to me, and that's why I can isolate it, and when am I having another behavior, you know, that likes pushing that other person's button for whatever ridiculous reason we have. Yeah. The thing about all of this is, if you have a daily meditation practice, it becomes much easier to notice these things. Because in the situation itself, we're so involved and the emotions come up quickly. And if our mindfulness and introspective awareness are not strong, we're not aware of them. And by the time they're strong, it's difficult to diminish them. So the trick really is in to have a daily meditation practice. And when these things come up in our meditation, or we take out a situation that happened before and remember it in our meditation, and then we examine it in our meditation, and not just examine it to understand it, but we think, what is the counterforce to this particular affliction? Yeah, and then we practice seeing the situation in a different way in our meditation, so that, and we do this enough so that then seeing the situation in a new way becomes a new habit, instead of always seeing the situation in the old way. So it takes time, but I think the real important part is our daily practice there. Yeah. It's like the situation is when you go to the DMV to take your driving lesson, your driving test, okay? You don't go to the DMV without practicing how to drive beforehand. Yeah? So if if the situation's like being at the DMV, then we have to practice the antidotes beforehand. Yeah? And learn how to notice these things in our mind. Learn what the antidotes are. Become familiar with them so that we remember them. Yeah. So that we aren't going in cold.
And if we find ourselves not keeping pure ethical conduct, what might be some ways we can purify?
Yeah, well, we do with the four opponent powers. Mm-hmm. So having regret, then taking refuge in the three jewels and generating love and compassion and altruistic intention for them, making a determination not to do it again, and then the fourth is some kind of remedial behavior. So that could be offering service to the community, it could be meditation, or chanting the names of the Buddha, or making offerings, or bowing, or there's many different kinds of remedial behavior. Okay. So, let's close now.
Into this merit may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forever.